Okay, we're beginning here on the top of Mem Gimel Amud Aleph, six lines down. Bai Mine, Rabbi Avina mi Rav Sheshet. Rabbi Avina queried Rav Sheshet and said, Bat Hanizonet Mina Achim, a daughter who is collecting from the estate monies to support her. Maaseya Deha Lemi, her output, her productivity belongs to whom? Bimakuma Av Kaime, the brothers here, when they are taking over the estate, stand instead of their father, Mahatam Maseya Deleav. When it comes to the daughter-father relationship, it's obvious that the Maseya Daim go to the father, Hachanami. So to in our instance, Maseya Deleachin, the output, the productivity of this young girl will go to the brothers. Odilma Lo Dami Laav. Or maybe that's not the case. They are not similar to the father. Hatam Midide Midzano. Over there, she get supported out of the father's money. Hacha labmididhu mitzana. Over here, she does not get supported out of the brother's monies. Now, the truth is, that could be from two standpoints. One standpoint, as Rashi points out, is the fact that the daughter is entitled to mizonot from the estate as it's nai kutuba, as part of the conditions of the kutuba. So she has rights to collect out of the estate, and it's not from them that she's getting it. It's not there of their own volition and voluntarily. They are compelled to do this because of the ktubah. But you also could say it from the perspective of the estate, that the estate is the father's estate, and she's really taking mizonot out of the father's estate. And whatever mizonot she takes from there is really something that is not entitlement, or the brothers are not entitled to. And therefore, the question is, how do we view the brothers vis-a-vis the estate? Do we view them as stepping into their father's shoes, and therefore the Maaseh Yadayim should belong to the brothers? Or do we see them simply as executors of the estate, and therefore, since she has a claim against the estate based on the ktubah, then they are simply allocating a portion of the estate to her, but it's not like they are feeding her. And it's more emphasized by the fact that by a father, we're going to learn later on in the Gemara that there's no obligation of the father to support his daughter. Since there's no obligation when he does support his daughter, if it's his own volition, it's voluntarily that he is supporting his daughter. And therefore, the Chachamim were mitaken mishum eva, that the daughter give her maaseh yadayim, her output of productivity, to the father. So over there, since it's something he does of his own volition, therefore we repay him with the maaseh yadayim in order that there won't be eva, or disinterest on his part in supporting the child, or animosity to the fact that he's supporting her and she's keeping her own maaseh yadayim. That doesn't exist by the brothers, again, because they are compelled to feed her because of the ktubah, and also it's not their monies that is taking care of her. Now the question, according to Tosafot and many of the Rishonim here, is a rabbinic level question. Mido raita, they think that it's clear that the maaseh yadayim of this girl belonged to herself. The only question is, were the rabbonon mitakein for the benefit of the brothers here, that the maaseh yadayim of this girl go to the brothers? Just like with the father at a doraita level, the maaseh yadayim of the daughter technically should belong to the daughter. But mishum eva, they were mitakein that it goes to the father. So amalei tinitua, we have a Tanaic work that tells us this, which we're going to see in a Mishnah later on. Almana nizonet minichsei yitomim umaseyada shelahen. The widow, after the passing of her husband, she can continue to live off the monies of the estate, but in exchange for living off the monies of the estate and being supported by the estate, her maseyadaim, her output of productivity, is given to the brothers, or basically back into the estate. Mar says, midami. That's not comparable. You're giving us the example of a widow. You can't compare a widow to a daughter. Amanato lo nechale beharvacha. The widow is not comfortable with taking without giving. She does not want welfare. She does not want to be supported without giving something in exchange. Bito nechale beharvacha. That's not true by the daughter. By the daughter, she's more comfortable taking without having to put something back in, partly because she feels a certain amount of entitlement. The father would have supported her, would have provided her in the dunya, and therefore she expects similarly out of the estate that the father, as if alive, would have supported her, and therefore she says it's an entitlement of sorts to her, and she doesn't feel compelled to repay the estate or put her masei yadayim into the estate, because now she's really on her own going forward, and she wants to keep her masei yadayim. Mar says, lememra de bito adifale ma'amanato. From that, you would conclude, in terms of hierarchy, that the daughter is better off than the almana. The daughter collects mizonot out of the estate and keeps her masei yadayim. The almana collects mizonot or supported out of the estate, but she has to pay her masei yadayim back, which would indicate that the daughter sits in a better position vis-a-vis the almana. V'hamar Rabbi Abba, am Rabbi Yossi, asu almana itzalabat, kibat itzalachin b'nichasin mu'atin. They made with the relationship between a widow and a daughter the same relationship as a daughter towards the brother when there aren't sufficient assets in the estate to support everybody. Ma bat etalachim, when there aren't sufficient monies in the estate to support both the sons and daughters or daughter that is a part of the estate. Habat nizonet, the daughter gets supported out of the estate. Vahachin ishalu ala ptachim. And the brothers have to go around and ask for tzedakah and has to be supported outside. We'll see this later on in the Gemara, because the ziluta, the going out to the public and asking for funds, is much less for the brothers than it is for a girl. And therefore, the Gemara determined that the daughter gets that right to stay and be sustained out of the estate, and the brothers will have to go and collect. Now, even though can be the oraita, technically, the Yerusha belongs to the sons, and the daughter has nothing in the estate. Part of the ketubah is that the daughter gets precedence in this case when there are limited assets, and she will be supported out of the estate, while the brothers go around and collect at door to door. Af almana itzalabat. So too, the widow by the daughter, if they are just a widow and a daughter that are here in the estate, almana nizonet, the almana gets sustained out of the estate, v'abati shalab tachim. And the daughter will have to go around and collect tzedakah. And again, for similar reasons, which is that for the almana, it's a greater ziluta to go out to collect door to door versus the daughter, or in incurring the sympathies of others, the daughter will be better at collecting the tzedakah or getting monies for herself. And as Tosafot points out over here, this case of the almana and bat, he says, "V'nira l'ri, d'davka b'yesh almana ubanim ubat tiknu l'almana." It's only in a case where there are brothers, a daughter, and an almana, did the almana get precedence, and therefore, first one to get knocked out of the estate with limited assets are the sons. The second one to get knocked out is the daughter, and the almana is the last because she collects from the estate. But a case k'she'ein ela almana ubanim, in a case when there's only a widow and sons. Oh, almana ubat, or there's an almana and a daughter, shabbat yoreshet, in that case the daughter becomes the real doreita, inheritor of the estate, lo asu takana bishvil almana. In that case, they did not protect the almana. So in a case where it's just the brothers and the almana would be out, and if it was just the daughter and the almana would be out. It's only in a case where there's almana, bat, and bonim. There we say that the almana gets precedence, because mishum d'almana lo ratzu laftia la hayirusha. In order to feed the almana, they didn't want to ruin Yerusha de oraita. But when we already are mitakein for the daughter to undermine the Yerusha of the sons, because in the case where there's a daughter and sons and there's limited assets, the sons get knocked out of the Yerusha and the right is granted to the daughter. Once we've done that already, we will also grant the almana precedence and say that she will trump the daughter. And why did they allow the Yerusha to be changed for the daughter and not for the almana? So Tosafot says, because in some instances, the daughter really is the Yoresh. She is able to be the one who collects on the estate. If there are no sons, then the bat is Yoreshet. So since in some instances, the bat is a real inheritor over here, therefore the Chachamim are mitakein whenever there's a daughter versus the sons, that they knock the sons out and give it to the daughter when they're limited assets. But the almana, who has no real rights to the estate, in a sense, because she's not the real Yoreshet over here, therefore, when there is already a change in the Yerusha from the sons to the daughter, we'll give the almana rights. But in the cases where the almana had no previous rights, because in a case where there is only Yerusha and we're not going to move it. We won't move it solely for the rights of the Almanah, because she's not a Yoreshet in the other instance. And the Ri really proves it from the fact that the Gemara calls this Nechasim Mu'atim over here, which are limited assets in the estate. Because really, vis-a-vis the Almanah, limited assets are not really relevant, because the Almanah can choose to stay in the estate forever. As long as she does not collect her Ketubah, she can stay in the estate. So how do you determine in that case Nechasim Mu'atim or Nechasim Rabim? You can't make an assessment of a lot or a little, because she will stay there and there's no real limit or value that you can assign to what she's going to get. Whereas by the daughters, there's much more finite time, which is until they get married or the fixed amount to get them in the dunya. There are amounts that you can calculate to determine whether the estate is large or small. Therefore, since the Gemara here uses that terminology, that's why the Ri says that the case here where the Almanah gets precedent over the Bat must be a case where there is an Almanah, daughter, and sons, and therefore we can talk about Nechasim Mu'atim. So the Gemara says, Le'inyan Ziluta, Almanato Adifale. That's not a problem. In terms of the person's personal stature and the shame of going door-to-door to collect, over there, there's a hierarchy. The sons are at the bottom, then the daughter, then the Almanah. The Almanah is the last one we want to go out to collect. But the Inyan Harvacha, but when it comes to taking benefits out of the estate, Bito Adifale, then yes, we will say that the daughter has precedence over there, because the daughter is willing to take without giving back. She has a certain entitlement and sense of entitlement to the estate, and therefore she doesn't feel compelled to give her Masei Yadayim back in. The Almanah, who is a mature adult and wants to support herself, feels like she doesn't want to just take out of the estate. She wants to contribute in exchange for the benefits that she derives from the estate. So yes, these two cases are not parallel. In one case, the Almanah will take precedence over the daughter. In the other case, the daughter will have a better setup than the Almanah. So Meiti Rav Yosef. Rav Yosef challenged Rav Sheshet from our Mishnah. Maseya Deha Umitziyata, her output and her objects that she found, Mitziyot, Afopish Lo Gavta, even though they have yet to be claimed or collected by the father, Meitav Harein Shelachim, they're still considered to be rights that have been monetized already, and therefore if the father passes away, the brothers get them. Taimod Debechaya, seems clear from my Mishnah that it's only during the lifetime of the father that the father is entitled to the Masei Yadayim of the daughter. Halachar Mitatav, but from here you would mean Dayek, that after the father passes away, Leatzma, that they go to her herself. The Mishnah creates a line of Meitav. Anything prior to that line belongs to the brothers. Anything after that point no longer belongs to the brothers, it belongs to herself. My love, Binizonet. Isn't it a case where she is deriving sustenance out of the estate, and she was being sustained or supported by her father, and continues to do so after his death, and yet there's a cutoff line here which says that until the death of the father, it belongs to the father or to the estate. After that point, it belongs to herself. It says, lo, bishaina nizonet. It's a case where she did not take mizonot. I bishaina nizonet, if she's not taking any sustenance out of the estate, Maila Memra, then what is the question over here? Now, you can see this question in two ways, which is when it says any nizonet, Rashi seems to indicate this way, and the second way that Tosfot explains and favors is that any nizonet means that she both did not take sustenance or support from her father, and she continues not to do so after the death of her father, meaning that she wasn't sustained in the lifetime of her father, and she's not being sustained after the lifetime of her father through the estate. There is one other way to view this. It was while her father was alive, she was taking sustenance or being supported by her father. But once he passed away, she did not take out of the estate any nizonet. And the Gemara says, Maila Memra, what type of chiddush are you going to get out of that? Clearly, if she's not taking anything out of the estate, her Masei Yadayim belong to herself. So that's no question. So what are you going to say that the diok is beforehand? That even though any nizonet, even though she did not take sustenance out of the estate or was not supported by her father, that her Masei Yadayim would belong to the father despite that fact? Is that what you want to be Midayik out of the Lashon? Afilu Laman Damar. Even according to one who says, Yechol HaRav Lomar LeEved, a master can say to his Eved Knani, Asei Mi Ve'eni Zancha, you work for me, And I will not support you. I will not give you mizonot. That deal or that type of transaction is permissible. Hani mili be'eved k'nani. But that's only true when you're talking about an eved k'nani. Delok tev be'imach. Because there, the word imach is not used. Aval eved ivri. By an eved ivri, dichtiv be'imach. Because the word imach is used over there. Lo, that's not the case. Imach means shavei itcha. He has to be equal to you. And since it's equal to you, it means that you have to support him. You have to provide him mizonot and sustenance, just like you would support yourself or take care of yourself. The word imach itself is somewhat controversial as to where it comes from. Some say that it comes, you can see here, the way that the Torah Or has it quoted, it's from Dvarim, which is kitov lo imach, because it's good, his life is good with you. Imach means b'sheveh itcha. Tosafot rejects that as being the explanation, because there it's just telling a story. Telling you why does the Eved want to stay is because Tov lo imach. But he rather says that it comes out of the Pasuk in Vayikra, which says that Kisachir kitoshav yeimach. That it comes from that Pasuk in Vayikra rather than the Pasuk in Devarim. But either way, with regards to an Eved Ivri, it's clear that you cannot create a situation in which the father says, I'm not going to support you, but I'm still going to take your output. And Koshekein, Bito, his daughter is no worse off or no different than that, especially if you say that his rights in his daughter are because he could sell her as an Amma Ivriya, which immediately means that he has the lien on her future output. He can either keep that for himself, or he can sell that to another party. And since that right in his daughter is really like or similar to that of an Eved Ivri, then over there, certainly he can't come up with a situation or create a deal in which he will not support her and she will still be paying Masei Yadayim to him. So that can't be the deal, that can't be the limud that we're getting out of this, that the daughter was any nizonet, was not being supported, and yet her Masei Yadayim were still being given to the father. Because it's just not true. You won't have a circumstance like that. So Amar Rabba Barula lo nitzrucha la hadafa. It has to do with the excess. The excess that the girl has above and beyond what is needed to sustain herself. And according to the first Lashon of Tosafot, when the Gemara says here, it's clear that the brothers can't set up a relationship like that, where they would not sustain her out of the estate, and yet they would still be, or have the right, to collect her Masei Yadayim. So that certainly can't be the explanation, because by an evidence now like that, they brothers certainly can't set up a relationship like that with their sister. So Amar Rabba Ba'ula, no nitzruch ela hadafa. We're talking about the excess over here, meaning that in regards to the core of her Masei Yadayim, they cannot set up a relationship where the Masei Yadayim would belong to them and not sustain her. So if we're talking about a case, she ain't in his own it, where she's not getting sustenance, whether it's vis-a-vis the father, whether it's vis-a-vis the brothers, There is no entitlement to her Masei Yadayim. But what happens if she makes an excess of that? She's able to produce an excess of her needs for her Masei Yadayim. Who does that excess, who does that hadafa belong to? Do the brothers have entitlement to that? And that's really the question that the Mishnah is dealing with. And saying that with regards to that hadafa, in the case of any nizonet, that hadafa will, during the lifetime of the father, belong to the father. But after he passes away, the brothers will not necessarily have entitlement to that hadafa. What the father does with that hadafa is interesting. Most say that that hadafa is actually put away and escrowed for the girl when she finishes, quote-unquote, working for her father, meaning that when she grows old enough to be on her own, or if she gets married and then the hadafa will be returned to her. There are some Rishonim who suggest that that escrow can be used in times where her productivity goes below the amount that she's taking out of the estate. So the father keeps it in escrow for that protection until it's completely become a bogeret or married off. And then if there's any excess left, she will get it. Amar Rava. Rava says about that answer, Gavar Rabba ki Rav Yosef lo yada d'ika hadafa. When Rav Yosef posed this question, he clearly knew that there was this issue of hadafa. And he would not have asked the question or posed the question if he knew that was the answer. Bekamoti ifti yufta. And he still asked the question anyway. Our Mishnah has an internal problem in it, and that's what stimulated or sparked his question over here. Because says that her output and her mitziah Afopishalo gavta, even though they were not collected. Mitziata, miman gavyo. Who do you have to collect the mitziah from? The mitziah is in her hand already. So what does it mean that it was yet to be collected? That doesn't make any sense in the context of the statement about a mitziah. Elav hachika amar. Must be, this is what it's saying in our Mishnah, Maseyada ki mitziyata, that her Maseyadaim have the same din as mitziyata. Ma mitziyata b'cheye av la'av. Just like her objects that she finds during the lifetime of her father go to her father, la'char mitatav la'atzma, and it's clear after the death of her father that they go to herself. There's no reason to give the mitziyah to the brothers after the death of the father. It's her own. Af maseyadeh nami. So too, or similarly, her maseyadayim are parallel to the mitziyah. B'chaya av la'av. During the lifetime of the father, they belong to the father. Achar mitatav la'atzma. And after the death of the father, they belong to herself. Shma mina. And that's Rav Yosef's question challenging Rav Sheshet. Rav Sheshet is telling us that the maseyadayim of the girl belong to the brothers, even after the death of the father. And Rav Yosef is saying, our Mishnah is miduyeket, the opposite. Our Mishnah is trying to say that maseyadayim look like mitziyah. And just like there's a cutoff at the death of the father for mitziyah, so too for maseyadayim. And that was his challenge to Rav Sheshet. Itmar nami. We have a similar memra from the Amoraim. Amar Yehuda Marav. Bat nizonet minachim. Maseyada le'atzma. They have something that supports Rav Yosef's understanding of the Mishnah, that Rav Yehuda in the name of Rav says that a daughter who is being sustained out of the estate, still her Maseyadayim belong to herself. Amar Rav Kana, my time. What's the reasoning behind Rav's position? So even though, as we said before, according to Tosafot, midoraita, it seems obvious that the Maseyadayim of the girl belong to herself, so the Gemara here is asking, oh, so then why does Rav say that? Rav says it because the Oraita, they belong to herself. But the Gemara's real question, or underlying question is, despite the fact that we might have thought otherwise, that the Maseyadayim should belong to the brothers, nevertheless, we still say that they belong to herself. And the Gemara wants to know why that is. Why is it? And Tosafot himself asks about the proof of the Gemara, saying, why was it necessary? So Tosafot shows that maybe it's necessary for a Ketana, but the case of Tana, where the Tana's Maseyadayim go to the father because he has the right to sell her, in that case, maybe those rights should be passed to the brother. Why are the rights of the father abrogated at the death of the father? They should just be passed into the estate. Therefore, the brothers should maintain the rights to the output of this girl. So why is that not the case? So this is the proof to that. Amar Kana, my time of dichtiv, binchaltem otam livnechem achreichem. This is talking about an Eved Kenani, that Eved Kenani is like real property, and therefore it is given in Yerusha from a father to a son. Otam livnechem, v'lo benotechem livnechem. They, the Eved Kenani, is passed as a Yerusha, is like real property, but daughters is not like that. Magid, shein adam marish, zuchut bito libno. And that says that the father does not grant rights he has in his daughter to his children. Meaning that if the father has rights to the daughter and has been monetized before his death, then that passes in Yerusha to the children. But the rights themselves do not pass from the father to the children. And so therefore over here, just because the father had the rights to the Maseyadayim, those rights are not necessarily passed to the children in order to, or the brothers, in order for them to collect from the daughter these Maseyadayim. So Matkiflav Rov Rabo Vema Bepitoi Abat, v'kunasot v'chavalota katuv midaber. Who says that that's talking about Maseyadayim over there? Maybe that's talking about other rights that the father has, that the father has the rights to the payments of pitui and the kunasot and chavalot and damages that are done to her. V'chein tana, Rabbi Chanina, v'pitui abat, v'kunasot v'chavalota katuv midaber. And so too, we have a braita that was brought by Rabbi Chanina that also suggested the same thing, that the monies or rights that we're talking about here have nothing to do with Maseyadayim. They have to do with restitution and compensation that the daughter receives that would belong to the father. Gemara says, wait a minute, is that really true? Chavalot, tzara d'gufa ninu. Chavalot, damage that's done to her is pain that was directly caused to her, and that money or damage that's caused to her actually belongs to her. Those payments don't belong to the father. They belong to her. And as Rashi says, the Gemara in Baba Kama tells us, that you actually put those monies into escrow for the children for when they get older. But it's restitution or compensation to the child, not to the father. Now, it's clear that you could still explain the statement of the Pasuk with regards to Knesot and to Pitui, and you could give that explanation. This doesn't undermine the explanation. It seems like the Gemara is just clarifying, okay, why is it that you would suggest that Chabalot belong to the father? Samar Rabbi Yossi Bar Chanina Shepatza Bifana, that he damaged her in her face. And the way that Rashi explains it over here is, De Ifchata Mikaspo, he diminished her value. De Ite La'av Dilehu, and since the value of the father, the right of the father to marry her off or to sell her as an Amma Ivriya now is impaired by this damage. And because of that, that damage or diminution in value is actually a problem for the father because he has those types of rights. So we could be talking about chavalot. Chavalot that, first of all, the pain, that might belong to the daughter, but there's a certain diminution in value that happened here, and that diminution in value is the father's right, and he will collect that, or that will be his rights. That's the way that Rashi reads it. Other Rishonim, and you can see in Tosafot already dealing with this, which is that they're different things that you could talk about in terms of damage. You could talk about damage which actually causes the daughter not to be able to do work or do Masa Yadayim. So in that case, the Shevet or the restitution actually go to the father because those are his rights. So when it says Shepatza Bifana, some suggest that means it was something that was done to her that did not diminish her ability to produce or Masa Yadayim for the father, and therefore that's why it belongs to her in that case. The money belongs to her. Just the opposite of what Rashi is saying over here, that there is no diminution in value to the rights of the father. Amar of Zeru, Amar of Matna, Amar Rav, V'amilah, Amar of Zeru, Amar of Matna, Amar Rav. So here you have two versions of how the memor was brought. One of them says it came from Rabbi Zeru, and one of them came from Rebbe Zeru. As Rashi points out, that they're both the same person, it's just that Rabbi Zeru made Aliyah from Bavel. There was no smicha in Bavel, so therefore he was known as Rav Zeru then. When he went to Eretz Yisrael to learn by Rabbi Yochanan, he got smicha, and then before he became Rabbi Zeru. So in that case, the question of the memra is, was this memra from Rabbi Zeru while he was still in Bavel? Or was this memra from Rabbi Zeru when he was already in Eretz Yisrael? Either way, it's brought in the name of Rav, Bat Anizonet Menachim Maseyadel Yatzma. And we have a similar statement that we had before from Yehuda Marav, which is that Rav believes that when the daughter is sustained out of the estate, the brothers have no entitlement to her Masa Yadayim. They belong to her. And he darshens it from the pasuk that we wrote before, that the rights of the father can be passed with regards to an Eved Knani from the father as a Yerusha to the children, but that's not true with regards to the daughter. And he sees that speaking about this issue of Masa Yadayim. So Amarle of Yimi Bar Papi, Shakud Amra, that was actually said by Shakud and not by Rav. Shakud Manu. Who is Shakud? Shmuel. Shmuel was known as Shakud, as Rashi points out over here. He was known as that because Halacha Kimoto B'dine Mimononot. Halacha is always like Shmuel versus Rav when it comes to Dine Mimononot. And therefore, he was Shoked al Dvarav Lomram Keilchata. He was very careful to say his words, that his position would be the position L'Halacha. The Aruch, on the other hand, says that it comes from the word Shoked al Dalte Torah, that he used to spend a tremendous amount of time by the Beit HaMidrash, that he toiled in Torah, and therefore he got the nickname Shakud for Shmuel. So the Gemara says, but HaRav Amra, why is he saying here that Shmuel said it? We know that Rav said it. We already have two memrot in the name of Rav, one from Rav Yehuda and one from Rav Zeru, suggesting that Rav did say this. He says, Eima Af Shakud Amra, that not only did Rav say this, but Shmuel also agreed with this position of Rav. Amar Mar Bar Ameimar the Ravashi, Hachi Amre Nardai, the Nardai say over, Hilchata Kavate Rav Sheshet. The Loch is like Rav Sheshet before, who says that Habatan Izonet, that a daughter who takes sustenance out of the estate from the Achim, Maseya Deha, her output belongs to the Achim. Ravashi Amar, Hilchata Kavate Rav. Ravashi himself says the Loch is like Rav, who says that Bat Hanizonet Min Achim, Maseya Dele Atzma, that even if she's sustained out of the estate, the Masidaim belong to her. Behilchata, now the Gemara says, the loch is, kavate de Rav, like Rav, that even when a daughter is sustained out of the estate, the Masay Yadayim belong to herself. She does not have to contribute them to the estate. They do not belong to the brothers. Now we begin the Mishnah. Mereset bito, vigerasha. If a person halakhically has a daughter take a rusin or be engaged, and then she's divorced from that engagement, if she got halakhically engaged and then was widowed from that, ktubata shelo. The ktuba at that point belongs to the father. As Rashi points out over here, number one, we're talking about in cases or in instances where the arusa does collect a ktuba, which is not obvious. And it's talking about when she's still a na'ara or ktana. In those instances, the ktuba belongs to the father. Hesia. On the other hand, if he married her off fully through nisuin vigirisha, and then she got divorced, hesia v'nit armila, or he married her off and she was widow, this is to the point of nisuin, ktubata shela. At that point, she's already left the auspices of the father, she's on her own, and therefore the ktuba that's collected afterwards goes to her. So it depends. If she's divorced or widowed from the point of erusin, where the father still has rights in her, there he will collect the ktuba. On the other hand, when she's reached the point of full marriage, where she's left the auspices of the father, now has gone to her husband, now that the husband's out of the picture, when the ktuba is collected, it belongs to her. Review domer, harishona shel av. The first ktuba belongs to the father. The Gemara will discuss why he thinks that. Amrulo, they said back to him, mishisiya en avirishutba. Once she's married off fully, the father no longer has rights to her. And that's what we call a yitoma bechayayavia, that a girl can be classified as an orphan even in the lifetime of her father, because once she's been married fully, if that marriage terminates, whether it's through divorce or through the death of her husband, then she does not go back to her father. Her father no longer has rights in her. And therefore, the collection of the ktuba at that point should belong to her. Now, Gemara says, taima desia vigirisha, that he married her off, and then she was divorced. Hesia v'nit armila, and then he married her off, v'nit armila, and then she was widowed. That the scenario here seems to be that it's a case that this actually happened twice, that it's not just one woman like this, one woman like that, it's the same woman that was married off, and then divorced, and then married off, and then widowed. Aval nit armila tre zimne, but if she was widowed twice, tulo chaz yilin suve, then there's no longer a right to marry Begav Urche. And as a sidebar, the Mishnah actually teaches us this then, is Katasat Imlan Tana Kirabi. The Tana here is passing like Rabbi. The Amar betrays Zimne Havi Chazaka, that when something happens twice, that's already classified as a Chazaka. So over here, because it was two different issues, one was divorce, one was death, therefore she doesn't have a Chazaka. But on the other hand, if it was twice that she was married and widowed, then we say she becomes like a black widow. She has a chazakah to kill her husband now. And because of that, she will not get married afterwards, meaning that we won't let her get married to a third party, because there's a risk that that person would be subject to the same problem because of the chazakah that has been established by her. And so as Gagav, since the Mishnah changed the nature of how the marriage was terminated, it shows us that had it been two of the same, meaning that she was widowed twice, at that point we wouldn't let her get married a third time. Now, the reason why we don't allow a woman after she establishes a chazaka to get married might have to do with two things. It's a machlok in the Gemara in Yevamot, whether it's Mayan Goreim, or is it that Mazal Goreim. Now, from the first half of the Mishnah, you could be Medayek for the one who says Mazal Goreim, because there they never consummated the marriage. And therefore, you could be Medayek out of the Reisha to support that position that says Mazal Goreim. The reason the Gemara brings it from the Seif of the Mishnah by Nisuin is because even according to one who says Mayan Goreim, meaning that the intimacy between them is what causes the death of the husband from this woman, then even in the case here, we see we can be Dayek out of the Mishnah for Nisuin, that she consummated the marriage twice, and that's what caused the death. And therefore, no matter which reason you think it is that a woman who has a chazakah does not get married a third time, the Mishnah is Meduyeket. From the Reisha, from the Erusin, you could say it about Mazal Goreim. From the Sefer, you could say it about Mayan Goreim. In either case, you can see here that there is a sidebar that Tana is pointing out, that a chazaka can be established after two times, like the position of Rabbi versus the Chachamim, who think you need three to establish a chazaka. Although Tosfot does bring from the Rivan that he read the Mishnah slightly differently, he says that the reason the Mishnah is all about one woman, and the case is Nisuin in this latter half of the Mishnah is based after the Erusin in the first half of the Mishnah, and so that she failed in Erusin twice and then got married. The fact that she was allowed to get married that third time after failing in the first two was only when it was once by Gerushin and once by widow. Had it both been widowed, then she would not have been able to get married in the latter half of the Mishnah, since we're talking about one woman. Tosafot rejects that because he says then it would only support the position that says The reason that we do not allow a woman after he has a chazakah, being a widow, we don't allow her to get married again, is because of mazal gorim, because then it's only out of every sin. If you do it on based on the one that says mayan gorim, that would not be medyuked in the Mishnah, and therefore the Ri says that the deal is either out of the ratio or the seifa separately, not from the connection between the two. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Harishona Shalav. My time with the Rabbi Yehuda, what's the reasoning behind Rabbi Yehuda's position? Rabba v'Rabbi Yosef, Darmei Tavayu, Hol Mishat Erusin Zacha Behen Ha'av. Since the Erusin generated the obligation here, the father was already Zocheh in that collection of the Ketubah. And therefore, even though the divorce takes place at a later time, the father's rights here are not abrogated by that, because he already was granted those rights at the time of the Erusin. Meitiv Rav, is that really true? Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Rabbi Shona Shel Av. So like our Mishnah, Rabbi Yehuda says that Rabbi Shona Shel Av, but now, Mode Rabbi Yehuda b'me'areset bito, k'shehi k'tana. Rabbi Yehuda agrees in a case where he was me'ares, engaged halachically his daughter to a man when she was a k'tana, u'bagra, and then she already aged to the point where she was independent, b'charkach niseit, and then consummated the marriage after she was a bogeret, she'en l'viya rishut ba, that her father has no rights anymore in the ketubah. Am I? Why not? Hachanami leima. Let us say over here. V'hol mishat erusin zacha behenav. They have already had rights to this because erusin took place at a time where he did have rights. Once those rights are granted, why should they be rescinded at any point later on? Hele itmar hachi itmar. This is the way that you need to phrase the statement of Rabba and Rabbi Yosef so that it reconciles with the position of Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Rav Yosef Darmei Tamayho Ubirshuto Nichtavim. Since the Ketubah was written while she was still in her father's possession, therefore he has the entitlement to the Ketubah. So it has to do with when the Ketubah is written. And in general, the Ketubah is written at the time of Nisuin. So since the Ketubah is written at the time of Nisuin, if it was written while she was still a Ketana, therefore, Rabbi Yehuda says that he's entitled to it. If it was only written when she is a bogeret, then Rabbi Yehuda says that she's not entitled to it. So it has to do with the time of the writing of the ketubah. As long as the writing of the ketubah, which is at the time of Nisuin, is while she's under the father's auspices, Rabbi Yehuda will say it belongs to the father. If it's already while she's an independent girl, when she's a bogeret, then the father will have no rights to it. Now the Gemara asks the question, Umigva me'emad gavyo. From when does she make collection? Now, this question has a number of layers to it. The first question is, who is this going on? Tosafot over here suggests that this is a question within the Shita of Rabbi Yehuda. And within the Shita of Rabbi Yehuda, when does the collection time start? Meaning, since the writing of the Ketubah is so fundamental over here to the father's rights, therefore, when the father loses rights over here, does that mean that we've entered into a new era, in a sense, and therefore the woman also's rights only begin at that point in time? Or do we say the reason that the father no longer has rights is because he no longer has wrong rights in his daughter? But it doesn't mean that the daughter herself doesn't have rights back to the origination of this marriage. That's the way Tosafot explains it. Rashi, and Tosafot brings the second shita that seems to follow that, is that the question is in the shita of the Rabbanan. Even according to the Rabbanan, from when do you collect the ketubah? Now this leads us to a second machloka, which is a machloka between Rashi and the Rabbeinu Chananel. Rashi believes that the ketubah is written at the time of Nisuin. Despite that fact, the entitlement to a ketubah already starts from the Erusin. So a woman is entitled to her ketubah, the base of the ketubah, that which the Chachamim mitakein, whether it's a me'al almana or mataim for a betulah, that already starts at the time of Erusin. The ketubah is only written at the time of Nisuin, and within that point of the ketubah, they also add in the additional items or additional monies that are being placed inside of the ketubah. So the question of the Gemara here is, which one governs? Is it the time period from the beginning in the Erusin, that's what governs? Or is it the time of the writing of the Shtar and the Nisuin? Which one of those governs as to when she really has an encumberment on the husband's property? Whereas according to Rabbeinu Chananel, an Arusa is not entitled to a ketubah whatsoever. And if the husband of his own volition writes a ketubah, that's fine. But there's no entitlement. And therefore, the Gemara's question over here, even in the sheet of the Rabbonin, is if he wrote her a ketubah voluntarily at the Erusin, and then wrote her a second ketubah at the Nisuin, how do we view the first versus the second ketubah? Is the second ketubah undermine the first ketubah completely? Or is the second ketubah additive to the first ketubah? So according to Rashi, the question is, when is the encumberment happen for the ketubah that's written in Nesuin? Does it start from the Erusin when the obligation made in the Chachamim started? Or is it from the Nesuin when it's actually written? And for the Rabbeinu Chananu is, if they were to both written at both of those points in time, which one of those governs the time period of the encumberment? So Amar Rav Huna, Maneh Matayim Min Erusin. Rav Huna says that the 100 and the 200, that which comes from the Takara Chachamim, starts from the time of the Erusin. The Tosefet Min HaNisuin. And anything added on top of that is only from the Nisuin. So according to Rashi, that's because at the Erusin, there was no Ketubah written, but she had entitlement from the Takanat Chachamim, so the encumberment for that piece starts from then. Nisuin, he wrote the Ketubah, so that the added value that is placed into the Ketubah at that point begins its encumberment. On the other hand, Rav Asi Amar, Echadzeh min HaNisuin. Everything starts at the Nisuin, because that's the time period in which the Ketubah is written, and that's when the encumberment begins, because that's when the Shtar begins, that's when the Shtar is dated, and that will be the time from which he can collect back to. Obviously, the nafkamina being property that he sold between the Erusin and Nisuin, but that she has a right prior to those sales, and therefore she can go back and collect from those sales, or whether her right only started after those sales, and she cannot collect from the property that was sold between the Erusin and the Nisuin. According to the Rabbeinu Chananu, the Rav Huna says, Maneh Matayim Min Erusin, is because the original Ketubah, the core part of that will stay intact, but the Tosefet that is added on at the time of the Nisuin by the second Ketubah, that additional amount will only start or be encumbered from that period of time. Whereas, Rav Asi says the second Ketubah completely nullifies the first Ketubah that was written at the Erusin and replaces it, and therefore all the encumberment begins at that time. My says, Rumiya Rav Huna Hachi, did Rav Huna really say this? Vaha Itmar. Don't we have a statement? Hotsia Alav Shtei Ketubot. Woman comes and pulls out two Ketubot from her husband. Achat shel matayim, v'achat shel shlosh meot. One worth 200, and one worth 300. V'amar Rav Huna, and Rav Huna says, what do we do in this case? Bata legabot matayim. If she comes to collect the 200, then govam izman harishon, and she collects from the first time period. Now, according to Rashi, the order here is important, that it's 200 and then 300. The 200 is dated earlier than the later one, that is the 300. So now, she comes to collect. If she chooses to collect the 200, then she can collect from the original time period. Shlosh meot, from the 300, gova misman sheni. Then she can collect from the latter date. So she has a choice here. She can collect 200, but then she gets an earlier date, and she can collect from any property sold after that date. She chooses to collect the larger amount, the 300, she'll have to go by the later date. And based on that, she will collect the more money, but she will have less property that is encumbered to her if there was property sold between the time of the first ketubah to the time of the second ketubah. Vimita, if it is correct that which Rav Huna is saying, or the sheet of Rav Huna, tikve matayim mizman rishon, she should be at least fundamentally allowed to collect 200 from the first ketubah's time. Umeya mizman sheni, and the additional 100 from the second ketubah will start at that date. I mean, it's similar to what's happening here in the case of the question that we asked, migva meimat gavya, from when does she collect? Do we say that the second ketubah is undermining or erasing, nullifying the first ketubah? Or do we say that it's additive to the first? So over here too, why don't we say the same thing? If Rav Huna believes over there that it's considered to be additive and the core amount stays, and then you just add on the additional amount, so say the same thing here. There is a core amount. That's the 200, which is agreed upon by both ketubot. She'll get that from the first date. The extra 100 she'll get from the second date. According to your reasoning, she should be able to collect 500. Because here you have two ketubot. One written for 200, one written for 300. Why don't we say that he granted her two ketubot? So that's, why don't we say, chamesh meot kulam, you can take the whole thing. So my time is man rishon, 200 from the first date. Mitzalat meyam is man sheni, and 300 from the second date. Why don't you say that they're independent? It's 200 plus 300. Why are you saying that 300 includes the original 200? Ela chamesh meot my time alogavya. How come she doesn't collect 500 in the case of a ketubah for 200 and then a later dated ketubah for 300? Came to lokotov la tziviti vosifit lach talat mea amatayim. Because he did not add in a lashon in the second ketubah that says this 300 is an addition to the original 200. So achikam arla. So then, by not adding that lashon in it, he's saying one cancels the other. Which is, imizman rishon, gviat, if you want to collect from the first time, gavya matayim, you can collect 200. Inasmuch any gviat, if you want to collect from the second time period, then gviat lamea, meaning that the two both are mutually exclusive. You can either collect one or the other. So one or the other, and that's it. So hachanami. So let's say the same thing over here. Time of dilo gavya. The reason that she doesn't collect dilo katav la, because he didn't write there osipet lach mea amataim. And he doesn't say I added on 100 to the 200. Achule achilte the shibudo kama. Therefore, by collecting the second one, it is as if she is forgiving the encumberment that was granted by the first ketubah. So if the second ketubah is additive to the first ketubah, and it says it explicitly, then the first ketubah will remain intact, and she can collect extra, the full amount of the second ketubah from the second date. On the other hand, if it's not written as additive to the first ketubah, then it's one or the other. And therefore, if she so chooses to collect from the second one, she is mochelet. She resigns or relinquishes her encumberment from the first ketubah, because she's giving up that amount and the shibud, and she's collecting the larger amount from the second ketubah. If she chooses to collect from the first ketubah, then again, she's waiving her right to collect from the second ketubah 300. But as Rashi points out, avagabi tosefet hamosif b'cholak ketubot ala maneh matayim, so in the regular ketubot, where in addition to the 100 or 200, he adds on addition, kod vimbo, vosifet la mai de tatin rabbonon, we say that language, that we add on above the amount that was you're entitled to midrabanan in the ketubah, then hilkach lo achilto l'shibud akamo. Therefore, she does not relinquish her shibud from the first case, udekoi, and it stays in place. And that's why Rav Huna's shita is that the 100 or 200 is collected from the time of erusin, and the additional amount is only collected from the nisuin, because the fact that it uses a lashon of mosif shows you that the original shibud and the original amount stays intact, and this is just additive to that amount. It does not cancel the original amount. So for the same reason she can't collect the full 500, is the same reason why her shibud is either 300 at the later date or 200 at the first date. Because just like she can't collect the full 500, because we assume that since it doesn't have the language of vosif, that means that they are mutually exclusive or one cancels the other. So too, in the case where she chooses to collect, that's the same thing, that her shibud from the original one will not be subsumed in the second ketubah, because it doesn't have anything in there that indicates it's connected to the first ketubah. So she has to make a choice, 300 from the second date or 200 from the first date. Okay, we're going to stop here, three lines down on the top of Mem Dalet, Amud Aleph.